You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Greenbelters, it's 2 o'clock, so the hour has come. It gives me enormous pleasure to welcome Nick Lowles to the Pagoda stage this afternoon. I've just said to him that I think I've been receiving emails with his name in the sender box for as long as I've been receiving emails. It's just a testament to his tenacity as a campaigner, and not just a campaigner, the UK's foremost campaigner, I suspect, against the far right and against fascism on our shores. He founded Hope Not Hate as its own institution more than 20 years ago. That came after a period working for Searchlight, having grown up in the UK and given his life to the cause of exposing and opposing the far right in the UK. And despite the travails of that fight, he still, when he was interviewed by The Guardian recently, he still felt able to say that he retained a belief in the fundamental decency of human beings. And it's a huge, huge pleasure to welcome Nick to the Pagoda stage this afternoon. Nick Lowles.
Thanks very much, Nick. Have to say I'm slightly nervous, not only because of the wonderfully large crowd here, but this is my first ever festival I've ever been to in my life. So, and I'm competing against some music in the background. But look, it's really good to be here. And hopefully what I want to do over the next kind of 20, 25 minutes is kind of, I guess, share some of my experiences and fundamentally say why I'm optimistic. And sometimes that is difficult, and there are times where it is hard to be optimistic, and it's easy to feel demoralized with what's going on in the world and what's going on in Britain. But as Nick said, I do have a ultimate kind of faith in human beings and faith in the British people. And that's what I want to kind of start talking about today. It really is about hope. Hope, which is obviously in our name, and we chose the name Hope Not Hate specifically for that reason. I'll talk a bit, little bit about that. But hope is good and not bad. It is positive and not negative. It is optimistic, not pessimistic. And it is when we lose hope that the fear, the unease, and sometimes the hatred can seep in. And I think that's what we're seeing really in Britain, across much of the world today. It's a loss of hope that is allowing the forces of extremism, of division, of hatred in, preying on people. And I think that what we have to think about is how we recapture hope. And it's not just a word, it's not just a feeling, it's not just an emotion. But hope is how we live our lives, and hope is about offering a future to people. But before I talk about that, I want to just recount one story that has always inspired me. Because, as I said at the beginning, I have faith that when people are given an option, people do choose hope over hate. And this was an example that was close to my heart, because I got to know the person involved really quite closely a bit later. Does anyone remember the TV series The Choir, Gareth Malone, where he'd go into a community, he'd get people singing, and obviously a bit of light entertainment, but it was about building community. The first series that he ever did was in South Oxley, which is just north of London, between London and Watford. And it's one of those, what they would call 1950s new build estates, that took people who had lost their homes or from the clearances after the World War II. And really, it might have looked nice at the time, but 40, 50 years later, it was a rundown estate, primarily a white working class estate where high levels of deprivation and high levels of racism. The British National Party at the time, and we're talking probably about 2006, 2007, the British National Party, which was the main kind of far-right fascist group at the time, had two local borough councillors and one county councillor in this area. The other political parties, principally Labour, hadn't really done any work for a lot of years, and people felt angry, abandoned, resentful. And there was this one black family on the estate. The woman was called Dee Johnson. Now, she had a gospel background, which meant when Gareth Malone came to town and asked for volunteers to be in the choir, she stepped forward. And because of her background, she had quite a good singing voice. And her voice stood out, and she was the kind of principal person in the choir. The idea was to have a 500-strong choir, community choir, running up to Christmas, and to have a kind of Christmas carols festival that brought the community together. Now, the final episode of this series was in, I think, I could be wrong, I think it was on November 2007. And obviously, Gareth Malone and the TV crew got to know Dee Johnson quite well over the time. And say, she was the one black person in this choir. And obviously, over the time, she had recounted what happened to her on this estate. The racism that she and her children had faced. The fact that she couldn't let her kids go to school alone. The fact that, you know, literally shit had been pushed through their doors. The wheels loosened the nuts loosened on the wheels of their car. The abuse they got in the street. And she recounted this on TV in the final episode. And what was interesting in that same week was a council by-election. Now, as I said earlier, the British National Party had won for the previous 3 years in this area. And the programme went out on the Monday or Tuesday night, and the election was on the Thursday. Nothing else had changed in that area. The political parties hadn't increased their campaigning. But I think the combination of her story and probably some guilt from people, but also the fact that the community came together and started to feel more positive about themselves, meant that actually when it came to vote, the British National Party vote dropped by half from 6 months before. And to me, this is an interesting story. And all the data, and I could quote data and polling, but that really isn't as strong as these kind of stories. All the data shows that the more people are engaged in their communities, the more people join together, mix together, talk together, not only the happier people are, but the more likely they are to find common answers to their problems. And there's a direct correlation between isolation and loneliness and support for extremism and negative attitudes towards the kind of other. So that's really my starting point. How can we positively bring people together? And I think, you know, it's also important to understand that there is a direct link between the loss of hope, economic, political, community, and negative attitudes. Last year, in preparation for this book, which I'm signing in a bit, we did a survey of 25,000 people. We do huge surveys. Our recent one was 45,000 people. And from that size survey, we can then use all sorts of data methods to estimate opinion down to postcode level. So we could test out attitudes, for example, to immigration. And there's a direct correlation. Literally, those streets that are most hostile to immigration, that are most hostile to Muslims and people of color and different religions, there's a direct correlation with economic deprivation and the loss of social capital. Seven out of the top 12 areas in our data were in Stoke-on-Trent. Now, I don't know if there's anyone here from Stoke-on-Trent. I've spent a lot of time in Stoke-on-Trent over the years. And it's a city that has its economic problems. It's a city that has gone backwards economically, where many people feel their good times have gone. And that has led to resentment, led to anger, led to feeling abandoned. And if you look at the coalfield communities, where we've had huge economic change over the last 40 odd years, where the main employment amongst men in the coalfield communities is warehousing. 35% of men in the coalfield communities work in warehousing, which is often night work, short-term work, zero contract hours, miles away from where they live. And in Yorkshire, where we have particular problems with, you know, in the past, the BNP, more recently Reform, etc., 65% of men in coalfield communities work in warehousing. And at the same time, you've had the change in gender roles in society. After the strikes of the 1980s, women moved into the workplace, principally in the NHS, local government, more secure work, office-based work. And so against this background, it's hardly surprising that people feel something's gone in their lives. And the glue in those communities, be it the working men's clubs, be it the high street, have gone. They've trapped, they were encouraged to buy their houses in the 1980s. And they can't afford to move out. The young people have left, leaving behind increasingly angry and resentful people. And I say this for three reasons. First of all, it's a fact, and we have to understand that. But it's also true that we can't just go in and challenge people on their attitudes in these areas without understanding some of the underlying drivers and addressing those underlying drivers. People often say to us, you know, let's say some far-right group does really well in an area, go in and do some anti-racism. That's the last thing that people want to hear, an outside group going in and say, don't be racist. But I also say this for another reason. This is particularly pointed at politicians who feel the pressure of the media, who feel the pressure of social media, who think that people are obsessed around issues like immigration and have to run after them. Actually, and that's not saying that there aren't issues around immigration and not saying that, you know, there are things that need to be sorted out, but ultimately, what's driving many of these people is far deeper than immigration. Immigration is just the outlet for their anger. So again, you know, we have to understand about the loss of hope and how that leads to fear and hate. So when we go into communities, and in my book, I try to combine an analysis of what's going on, try to understand the different threats we're facing, multiple threats we're facing, whether it's at the ballot box, whether it's online, whether it's on the streets, with both my experiences from 20 years, 25 years of campaigning against extremism and the far right, but also just kind of my kind of suggestions, my kind of views about what we can do. And I'm driven by a number of kind of key principles when we go into communities. Because I think, well, why we set up Hope Not Hate in the early 2000s, it was principally after the riots in 2001. For those who are younger than me, they might not remember the riots of 2001, but in Burnley, Oldham, and Bradford, we had riots in the summer of 2001. And I think for a lot of people, it was a kind of waking up that actually there were problems about cohesion in society. People were living parallel lives, and that it didn't take much to set community against community. And I think for myself and one or two others, we just felt that traditional anti-racism and anti-fascism wasn't working. It was either in the big cities where that wasn't the problem. It was in town centres and rallies and, you know, which again, it wasn't in the communities. It was name calling, just calling people fascist, fascist scum off our street, Nazi this, Nazi that. And when you get 30, 40% of a community voting for a fascist party, you have to really understand why are they voting for them. And just calling them names isn't going to help. So we thought we needed to do campaigning differently. And part of that was that we did some bit of research and we found that the BNP vote, like the Reform vote now, is primarily men, not women. That women were the tactical anti-fascist voters in areas. And it's not really because they were more positive about immigration. It's that they were more worried about what extremism could do in their communities, and particularly women of kids. And they're worried about the impact that extremism would have on their kids. But they also told us that they didn't just want to be anti. They wanted to be positive. They wanted to be for something. And I think it's a real tendency, we just pit ourselves against somebody else rather than rallying people to a value system that we believe in, that we want to live by. And so that's where Hope Not Hate came from. But there are a number of core principles that we operate from that I think, when I say them, it seems really obvious, but it's particularly when you're campaigning and you don't have huge resources, it's easy to forget. The first is quite simple. You have faith in people, that even people who might be voting for extremist groups or might articulate some negative views you don't agree with, many of these people can be won over. But you've got to treat people with respect as well. And you've got to differentiate between the party and the party activists and the people who might be voting for them or supporting them. Because as I said earlier, there's a whole number of reasons why people might support a far-right group. Fundamentally, we say you have to earn the right to be heard. I think there's a real danger in politics generally of political groups, activist groups, going into communities, telling people what to do, what to think, how to say things, what not to say. And in a world where people are increasingly cynical, ambivalent, sometimes hostile to politics and to outsiders and activists, it's so important that you have to win their trust first. And there's many times that we have gone into communities, not on an anti-racist ticket, not on an anti-fascist ticket, but doing something to help them to prove that we're on their side. Back in 2004, 2005, where grooming was a big issue in Bradford and Keighley, we were working up in Keighley, really deprived communities where the British National Party had been winning 40, 50% of the vote. And one of our organisers up there was a community development worker. And before we asked anything of them, we spent 6 months helping them raise money for a community centre, which they didn't have. We had to prove that we were on their side before we could ask something in return from them. Then the next thing I'd say is that we need to engage with people where they are, not where we are. And again, another major fault of all of us, including us at times, where we go in, we talk about the issues that we think are important, but they're not necessarily what local people think are important. And connected up with that is that every community is different. You learn from experience, you learn what's worked and what hasn't worked in areas. But you really got to understand the community before you can work in there, because something that works well in one area might not necessarily work in another. One place might have an asset that you can utilize, another place doesn't. So you've got to be flexible. You've got to understand the community. Everywhere is different. And one of the big things I say, I'm increasingly working with climate groups. One of the things, you know, we push really heavily is that you've got to link your issue to their lived experiences. I think, for example, in the climate world, after the kind of heyday of 2019, where even Boris Johnson was a big green and, you know, Britain was setting all sorts of net zero targets, since then we've had, you know, cost of living crisis, Ukraine war, now the Afghan war, energy prices spiking. It's an easy narrative for Reform and those on the right to say, even if you agree with climate change, we can't afford it. We've got our bills to pay. It's a luxury. It's middle class sandal wearers. It's nothing, to, you know, it's nothing. But we've got to link our issues. We can't go in talking about climate change and changing our lives in a way that people feel that they are barely struggling to put food on the table. So we've got to kind of work out. One of the things we're doing at the moment is starting to work with some climate groups for a campaign to put solar panels on schools. And then we're arguing that the schools should be allowed to keep the money that they save in energy so they can put it into books or put it into schools. So there's a direct benefit for communities. But you're telling a story about the impact of climate change and about ultimately how we can do something. You've also got to find trusted messengers. We're an anti-racist group, we're an anti-fascist group. If anyone looks online, there's lots of people who hate us, lots of people who abuse us or whatever. And sometimes in the community, we're not the best voices to transmit something. And you've got to find somebody else in the community who's got the credibility locally, and ideally not the credibility from a kind of political perspective. We learned this really early in a kind of slightly humorous way. Back in 2003, in the kind of Lancashire market town of Clitheroe, between Burnley and Blackburn, very affluent market town, there was a planning application for a mosque. And I say a mosque, it wasn't. It was to extend someone's front room by a meter so they could have a prayer room. There were 25 Muslims in this town. The British National Party were putting out leaflets, 25 today, 25,000 tomorrow. And coming just after the riots in Burnley and the election of the BNP in Blackburn, people were fearful. And the Conservatives who ran the council were saying, oh, look, we're not racist, but the noise and the parking, and, you know, we have to object to this extension of a room by 1 meter. And what we did, we sat down with our local group, and first of all, we used the Christian leaders were at the forefront of our campaign. We made it not about Islam or this building. We made it about the right to worship. We played into this, the feeling of this community that they were slightly better than some of their neighbours. And we said it's about a fundamental right. That's what society does. You have a British society, you have a right to worship. But it, our campaign coincided with the elections in 2003. And we had a series of leaflets over the course of those few months. And in the final leaflet, I asked our local group, I said, look, send me 6 quotes from local people, ideally with pictures, that we could put on the local leaflet. And it was all about, look, we're local people, it's a local campaign. And they sent in a picture of a man called Tony Rowlands. Now, Tony was the town crier. And the picture they sent in was Tony with his hat and his bell. And we were down in London, probably sniggering away at this kind of image of this bloke. We said, look, forget all the other 5. Let's just put this big picture of Tony on the leaflet. And it was like, join Tony against the BNP. And of course, in a market town, the town crier is probably the most famous person in the town. And certainly one of the most respected. He's not a political person. Everyone knows him. And at 6'7", everyone can see him as well. But so we stuck this image, probably in a slightly kind of, you know, humorous, stupid way. And we were amazed at the response. People were literally putting it up in their windows because everyone wanted to be with Tony because Tony was a big man in town. And it made us realize that in every single community, there are great people doing great things. And part of our job is to amplify what they're doing and is to give them the confidence, the courage, the resources, the skills, whatever, to speak up, because their voice is worth far more than anything we might say. So it's finding trusted voices. Just quickly moving on. Addressing difficult issues. There are difficult issues. And I think sometimes, you know, whether it's about immigration, whether it's about grooming, whether it's about crime, there are difficult issues that are dividing communities. And we have to face them down. Because it's our silence that means that only the other side are talking about it. And our silence means the other side are framing the agenda. And I'll give you an example. Grooming is a perfect example of this, where grooming in many communities in this country is a real issue. And we have been slow, we collectively on our side of the street have been slow to take it up. Grooming is wrong. we need to say that more forcefully, because we've allowed the others to racialize it, to weaponize it, and allow them to pretend that they're somehow the champions of these girls and women. And we've got to be honest, and we've got to be more robust, because it's about values. Wrong is wrong. Doesn't matter who's behind it or who does something. And we get credibility if we speak the truth. So I think we've got to be willing to address difficult issues, be positive and hopeful. I think it's very easy to let the other people set the agenda, to kind of fight hate with hate, to be aggressive, to be shouting. We always found during the years of the English Defence League, and we see it a bit now, where we understand why people do it. Good-minded people, they come out on the street, they want to have their demonstrations, totally understand they want a visual response to far-right protests or activities. But for a lot of ordinary people who are not on those demonstrations, they just see two groups of people shouting at each other. They see police helicopters, horses, they see roads blocked off, shops being shut. And I think sometimes we've got to think about not what makes us feel good, but how do other people feel about it? And I think sometimes we can do things slightly differently that makes us positive and hopeful and helps us contrast what we do compared to the people that we're opposing. Number nine, I'd say, is that in every threat is an opportunity. Now, often in the community, we come together because we're facing a threat, whether it's at the ballot box, whether there's been a racist incident, the far right are marching, and the initial reaction is about being defensive. But actually, their activity gives us a chance to organise people positively about what we stand for, about what a community stands for. And I think that it's not just about what we do on that particular day, it's what that day leads to. And we've done some great examples. I don't have time to go into them now, but they're in my book and everything like that, where we've used what is quite a terrifying situation, or where a lot of communities are really scared, to in a way have a celebration. What does it mean to be part of that community and involve people who are not normally involved? And it comes back to this thing I said at the beginning about kind of the values and Britishness and good. Because ultimately, the vast majority of British people are good, decent people. They have concerns about things like we all have concerns. But ultimately, people don't want our communities being torn apart. People want to live together in peace. People want to enjoy different cultures, different religions. They want all that. But the media narrative, and the social media narrative especially, is one of division and one of hatred. But in every threat, get people together, get people to think, and reach out to other people, and use the fear that these people are bringing to mobilize people and get people together. And finally, I'd say, is that what we don't do enough of is that small wins are so important, and celebrating small wins. Because a part of the problem as well is that there is a despondency amongst many people that drives people to the far right or drives people to extremism. Nothing can change. What's the point in voting? What's the point of doing this? It's all negative. They listen to Elon Musk and all the rest of it. But actually, things can change when people come together. And sometimes there's small changes, which won't change people's lives massively, but they might change people's lives in a small way. But once we can demonstrate that by coming together and in a way challenging the narrative of the far right, who say, well, we can't work with these people, we don't want these people there, whatever, we're stronger as one, then we can start to challenge, we can start doing that. Something that we started to do this year again, we used to do it a few years ago, but we started to do community newspapers. So in May, we did 24 different editions, all customized to a local community. And these will be quarterly newspapers in some of our key areas. And this is slow, long-term work, but this is about celebrating the community, celebrating good things that are happening, amplifying people coming together, encouraging people to get involved, but then also about addressing supposedly difficult issues in constructive and positive ways. And I think that sometimes we do stuff and then we move on to the next thing, but actually a lot of the stuff we all do in our lives is good things, and we don't spend enough time thinking about that and celebrating that and getting people to think about, right, what can we do next? So I just want to spend the last few, couple of minutes really just talking about faith engagement, and why it is so important for me and for Hope Not Hate to be involved with Faith Partners, but also the role of Faith Partners in society. And I stand here, I don't really have any faith. I can totally understand and I totally see why, not only why people do, but the power of it. But what I have seen firsthand is that time and again, faith communities and faith leaders are almost always at the forefront. And in every community around the country, faith leaders step up. They take a lead. They have a credibility in communities. And sometimes it's a bit of a cliche, you know, we get the faith leaders together and it's just the same six people that were in the photo last week about something else, whatever. But it is so important. And I think faith is increasingly part of people's identity. All the polling says that. It's increasingly influencing how we vote, how we think, how we look at each other. But it's also increasingly a fault line in society. The main narrative of the far right now, pushed both in this country but also by the likes of Elon Musk, is about a civilizational fight. It's about Islam being the supremacist religion, it's at war with the West, and ultimately it's going to lead to civil war. And I don't know if anyone has seen or read anything about civil war in the last couple of years, but when we first started to notice it 10, 15 years ago, it was literally real fringe elements of the anti-Muslim movement. And now you've got articles in the mainstream press about it. You've got big chunks of society thinking that civil war is going to happen between communities. And then you've got the far right, who not only think it's going to happen, who are not only preparing for it, but are looking forward to it because they feel that's the only way that they're going to drive Muslims out of the country is through violent civil war. And I think that both the role of faith communities, both it as individual faith communities, but also collectively, is really, really important. And one of the big things I'm trying to do at the moment is saying to people who are not in faith groups, we have a responsibility as well. Sadly, there are a number of people in British society, and particularly on the kind of progressive side of politics, who are kind of secular, who don't really like people of faith or don't really like institutions, and don't really go to them as partners. And in the struggle that we've got coming up over the next few years, not only is faith integral to it, but faith has to lead on it as well. And there are challenges within all the faith communities now between those voices are saying, you know, be it of separation, be it of, you know, have different views, and, you know, those who say we want to come together in our Christian beliefs or, you know, whatever religion. So there are battles within each community, ideological, theological battles. But ultimately, and particularly, I mean, I found with the different Christian faiths, they are the first port of call I make when we do something in the community. They know their communities. They have contacts. They have credibility. They have community spaces where they can bring people together. And ultimately, they are driven by the interests of their communities. So what I'd say is that whether you're involved in your local communities, whether you're involved in anti-racism, whether you're involved in anti-fascism, the fight we're now facing, I quite clearly see, is we're in the most dangerous time that I've ever been in terms of my adult life. And I say that not just because we're facing kind of the return of street violence, we're facing the prospect of a you know, possibly a reform government, you know, with its plans to deport millions of people, but issues that we once thought that we had won, Britain being a multicultural society, a black person can be as British as the next person, as the next person. All this is being contested now. The fact that Rishi Sunak, the former British Prime Minister, had to go on a radio show, had to go on a podcast to defend why he was British, it just shows how the Overton window has shifted. And we are seeing, even in this past week, we've had the Conservative Party, the shadow Home Secretary, saying that a future Conservative government would make British citizens who were not born in Britain would not be allowed social housing. So just think about that for a minute. It's basically advocating for an apartheid system where certain people, just because of where they were born, even though they are British citizens who pay British taxes, who might have children here, might have lived to 30, 40, 50 years, they're saying they're second-class citizens and they shouldn't be allowed things. That is how far the Overton window has shifted. And with the likes of Elon Musk there, pumping millions, giving hundreds of thousands to the likes of Rupert Lowe and Tommy Robinson to push their hatred online, that's what we're up against. But we've got the British people on our side. Even on things like immigration, where politicians are running scared, the vast majority of British people are far more nuanced, far more sensible on things like immigration than you would imagine if you read the newspapers or read social media. They're far more decent and pragmatic. And sometimes we have to have faith in British people because given a choice, they will choose hope over hate. Thank you.
Nick, thank you so much for giving us hope and for helping us to have faith. You've kindly said you'll take questions. I need to remind you, Greenbelters, that this session is being recorded. So if you don't want your question or your voice to be recorded, don't ask it in this forum. Wait until you're in the queue to meet Nick and to buy his book across the way at 5:30. Now, my colleague Tino is over there. She has the roving mic, and it looks like we have our first question.
I just wondered what advice you might have for faith leaders of talking into this area when their congregation might be scared of upsetting the apple cart. Last September, I preached on Holy Cross Day about the symbol of the cross and how it's being used by the far right as a symbol of hatred. And a member of my congregation very publicly got out and walked out in protest, which now means as a community, we're sort of scared to address the situation.
Try to take each question. I don't know that individual case, but what I can say is that I think with faith leaders, I think that they can't let things go unchallenged. But how they challenge it is obviously depending on the circumstance, where the congregation might be, and how to take people on a journey. Because I think that part of the problem is sometimes the rhetoric is it's very kind of polarized. You're with us or against us, you're there or you're there. And, you know, particularly at the moment where large numbers of people are kind of either nervous around immigration or feeling that, you know, accepting some of these kind of right-wing narratives. We've got to do things in a careful way. Now, that could be private conversations, or it could be finding new ways to address the issue that takes people on the journey. But ultimately, what I would say is that the worst thing that can happen is we don't challenge these views and we don't talk about it. And talking about last September, and, you know, I think many of us, myself included, felt demoralized, felt, I say scared, but, you know, after that Tommy Robinson demo of 150,000 people, that's what the police said, I think there's probably 250,000, 300,000. And after the summer that we'd had, where we'd had hotel protests, and we had all these things, that it was a failure of our political leaders to stand up, which left people, and particularly people of colour, feeling really scared, really isolated. So I think that some of the response has to be public, and that's not necessarily about calling someone out or addressing someone as individuals. It's about giving reassurance to a bigger group of people who might be worried about some of this narrative. But it's also about showing solidarity. Because I don't know if you experience this, but for me and some of the people I know, particularly people of colour, felt really scared last September, last October, with the flag protests and everything and the racism on the streets. And part of the reason they were scared was because people weren't showing them solidarity. So even if it's just on a personal level, reaching out to a friend or reaching out to a colleague or reaching out to someone in the congregation. So there's lots of different ways of doing it, but what you can't do is not talk about it at all.
Do you think the right-wing media is kind of like a threat nowadays with, like, you know, GB News, they have like shows hosted by like Reform MPs. And should that be allowed?
Clearly the right-wing media are a threat. I think what we also got to recognise as well is that when we talk about the right-wing media, we're talking about an ecosystem that goes beyond the traditional newspapers or even GB News. It's podcasts, it's magazines, it's Substacks, it's YouTubes, it's all these other platforms. And it's a plethora of people because people, you know, hitting people in different ways, some are more extreme than others, but it's all part of this ecosystem. But behind it all, there's two or three really rich people who are funding much of this. Not all of it, of course, but funding much of it. And they've got a real political agenda. GB News is a perfect example. Paul Marshall, who owns GB News, who owns Unheard, who now has bought The Spectator. We exposed him a couple of years ago. He had a secret X account, not in his name, in some, you know, name of one of his little businesses, where he pushed out this anti-immigrant rhetoric, the anti-Muslim rhetoric, the stuff that you kind of read in The Spectator now. So it is a threat. I don't think we should ban it, because I think that actually that will play into the hands. What we need to do is be able to counter it. And we need to be more effective at countering it, because I think that, you know, the right side of the street have built this ecosystem, and we don't really have that on our side. We have, you know, we have our podcasts and we have our Substacks or whatever, but generally they're preaching to the converted, and we got to find more interesting and new ways to reach people who won't necessarily identify politically with us, but they'll have many of the same views. And sometimes that's going, as I say, going to them where they are, not where we are. Could be going to them through cooking or lifestyle stuff or whatever, but, you know, it's, they've taken a huge leap forward. And then particularly when you've got people like Elon Musk, the way that he builds these algorithms, we're at a huge disadvantage. But, you know, unless that we've got some kind of billionaire on our side who's going to do the same thing, we just have to keep plugging away at what we do.
Yeah, it's sort of further on to what you've said. The community work that Hope Not Hate does is so inspiring and spreads so much hope. And I urge people to go on the Hope Not Hate website to see all the things, including like the planning, looking at how planning of communities affects isolation and also the building of community. But it's what you're saying. How do we, because that's very labour intensive and it affects a few communities, how do we get that message wider, especially when you have the social media algorithms that just put people into this cycle of hate? Is it worth challenging? And if we challenge it, how do we careful not to perpetuate another circle of hate, because that's what they're expecting from us? It's quite confusing, actually, when you're nice challenging someone, and if you're quite friendly, you're, oh, I like your dog, by the way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how do we get that message further? What can we do? Is it worth trying to challenge social media just to show that there is an alternative?
So, I mean, just an answer to that. I mean, it's difficult because it is very hard to challenge social media, because the whole way that social media is organised and the echo chambers, you know, what I say isn't going to have any impact on those people. They aren't going to see it. But what I would say, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, and I probably didn't go into it in any detail, but one of the things that gives me hope, one of the things that we need to kind of think about more is that there is a huge difference between how people see the country as a whole and what people see as happening in their local communities. And that's partly because they see what's happening nationally through the prism of the media, social media, politicians. Locally, it's their lived experience. And if you look at all the data, a big, big chunk of people think the country is falling apart, it's going into decline, everyone's stabbing each other, especially in London. You know, all these awful things are happening. And yet when you ask those same people about their local area and their local community, they think it's all peaceful and they think it's all nice. So, look, I mean, there's nothing we can really do about that. That's just the reality of the impact of social media, whatever. But that is why I think working in the community is so important. But it's not just about you've got to be doing anti-racism. Because the other thing that we've learned is this thing about that actually the more people who are involved in community, whether it's anti-racism or not, it could be a local sports group, it could be walking in the park on a Saturday, whatever it is, the more people are coming together, the more you're breaking down barriers and you're getting people to talk to each other. And all the data shows that's so important. So there's a couple of things we're doing. First of all, this year, and we did it kind of quite late on in the day, we set up something called A Million Acts of Hope. And this came from, as a result of the Tommy Robinson demo last September, where many of us were demoralized and deflated and didn't know what to do. I came together with a number of CEOs of major charities to say, look, what can we do collectively? They came to me and said, what can we do to help you? And I said, no, it's about what we can do together. And so in May, we had this initiative, Million Acts of Hope. 250 charities signed up to it, you know, from Hope Not Hate to Shelter to UNICEF to Women's Institute, Salvation Army, all these stuff. And we want to do it much bigger next year. And it's about celebrating the good that's in the community. Because the more you can get people thinking about the community, the more you're kind of, in a subtle way, breaking down some of the narrative that's getting pushed online. But there's other things that we're now pushing for. So, for example, with the new Andy Burnham government, we're pushing really heavily. They've got Pride in Place. They've got a lot of these other initiatives about devolution and everything. And we're saying it should be a statutory obligation of every council to have a cohesion policy. And they're going to have all this extra money. Well, let's use it to bring people together. Not just about on anti-racism or whatever, but just bring people together. So I think that we can counter social media, the media, but in a slightly different way. But again, I'm sure most of you are probably involved in 2, 3, 4 different groups, campaign groups. You sign up to things, you're members of things. And you can, it's not a job for one person. It's a job for all of us in whatever outlook we do to get out and talk to people and show people that we can make change, even in a very local level.
Thank you. First of all, you've given us some fantastic ways to build community and hope, and hopefully dilute out and particularly hold on to those who haven't yet joined the First Right. I think my question possibly relates very much to the question before, these little echo chambers and breaking in. Is there any, particularly I'm thinking of my brother's, getting very specific, a few of my brother's friends are still friends with me on Facebook and post very far right things. What sort of things should I be replying in those to try and get some message of hope within those very firm echo chambers?
Look, I mean, I think you've got to be realistic and careful sometimes, because you challenge your brother's friends, given where they are likely to direct abuse at you. You know what I mean? So how you challenge them is really important. But I think sometimes it can be done subtly as well as you know, in a more kind of open and confrontational way. But, you know, it can simply be posting positive stuff that challenges their narratives, or it could be trying to unpick some of the issues. But it is difficult, though, because I think, you know, again, one of the things that we've seen, particularly in the last 12 months, 15 months, is that the far right are not only becoming more numerous online, they're getting a lot more confident, a lot more aggressive. And now that there's sometimes a concerted effort to take on people, to bully them into silence, to, you know, my good friend Enver Solomon was head of Refugee Council until earlier this year. And, you know, he'd been there a few years, so that was obviously a factor as well. But he got heavily targeted on a kind of individual level, and that was a new experience for him. And they're driving good people out of it. And friends are losing, people are losing friends, and, you know, it's easy to get scared. So I think we've got to be careful how we do it. But I also think that we also need the government to get Ofcom to actually enforce some rules as well. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, we can talk about we need new rules for this, we've got rules. It's just the problem is that they are never enforced. We've got rules that can fine these companies. And these companies have no moderation, not only have no moderation, but actually deliberately set up their algorithms to amplify divisive and hateful messages. And look, we should take on the likes of Elon Musk. And that might not necessarily affect your friend, but actually it will have a broader impact. But I think, you know, I've also think that we've got to understand just how pernicious social media and these online forums are. In the beginning of my book, I talk about this story about this young lad who came to me beginning of last year, actually, just as I was finishing writing the hardback version of the book. And he'd been convicted of terrorism because of me. Well, because of Hope Not Hate. He was 19 years old at the time. He was convicted when he was 15. And we'd got inside this group. We didn't know at the time, they were all teenagers. We got involved in this group. They were kind of planning terrorist stuff and everything. And he told me he got radicalized in 2 months. From 2 months joining one forum on 4chan, and a forum that kind of was really horrible about women and, you know, laughed at people, you know, abused people. Within 2 months, he was plotting a terrorist incident. Now, he was 15 years old and he didn't go to prison and he had another chance. And actually, he said to me at the end of, I met him, and he said to me, I just want to thank you because you actually saved my life. I didn't think so at the time. I hated you, but you saved my life. But I tell you what was really interesting talking to him was that not only the speed now, that conversion, but also that what he was saying about what he liked about this online right-wing narrative, which was quite uncomfortable to me, because he was basically saying everything people like you would throw at us just made us want to do it more. Because you're so moralistic. You're telling us to think this, telling us to think that. We shouldn't do this. But the whole narrative of the right was, you'll be a better person if you do that. And it was all about power and being better and being stronger and being, you know. And it's like, a bit like the Andrew Tate thing. We can all say, quite rightly, what a horrendous man this person is. And look how he treats women. And look at his, you know, his links to racists and Tommy Robinson. But actually, for a lot of young men, it's like they live in a world where it's all about making money, getting rich quick, and he's there with his smart cars. And so I think sometimes we can sometimes take a very moralistic view against people, which is perfectly understandable, but actually, particularly for young people and young men, that can actually be counterproductive. And actually what we need to do is to find positive peers who are in that world. Now, when we started doing Hope Not Hate, we did these bus tours with the Daily Mirror. Boxing was a big thing for us. Multiracial sport. In every city, you had these gyms where, you know, it brought people together. And in a way, we need to, you know, go back and find some of these people. We're doing a project in Sheffield, in the East End of Sheffield, with a gym that used to be run by Brendan Inger when he was still alive. He had a whole load of world champions, and we knew him for years. Great, great bloke. But, you know, part of their stuff is about, through boxing, through giving people, not only making people feel fitter and, you know, giving them a bit of a future, but it brought people together, and he used their experience to break down barriers. It's the same, there's a great boxing project in Rotherham where after the riots, the bloke who ran the boxing club brought the young people together, some of them who had been involved in the riots, And not from a judgmental view, but just say, talk to me. Why? And so I think sometimes we've got to listen a bit more as well. Different from the older men. There's a big difference between boys and old men in this. Old men tend to be much more dogmatic in their views. But I do think how we do it, we've got to be careful. We've got to look after ourselves. Because they go, you know, on X, I'm still on X because you can't avoid it. You have to engage. For every post I put up, I probably get on average over 1,000 abusive messages. Now, you know, I'm used to it. Sometimes I look at them, most times I don't. But I, even for a lot of my colleagues, it's like, it's tough to read. It's tough to be abused. It's tough to read some of the language, what they're going to do to you, whatever. But, you know, so I think we've got to look after ourselves and we've got to find more subtle ways. You don't have to have a fight every single time.
And this will be our last question.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And one of the things that worries us is that Tommy Robinson seems to have hijacked a lot of Christian rhetoric into his message. Paul Marshall, I believe, funds a particular strand of Christian worship. There are a lot of people who are using Christianity as an excuse to be far right. And it's, I think as a Christian, that's one of the things that really makes us very worried. And I just wondered how we can address that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big thing that we've seen for the last 2 or 3 years. And partly it's a kind of appropriation of Christian imagery, language by the likes of Tommy Robinson and Paul Golding, Britain First, you know, walking around with a cross and all the rest of it. But I also think there's something more, probably more worrying and more pernicious going on inside elements of Christian theology as well, and particularly coming from the US post-liberalism, you know, that kind of J.D. Vance view of the world, that there is this kind of confrontational mindset, not only between kind of Islam and Christianity, but between liberalism and orthodoxy. And I think that this is really difficult. I think, first of all, we have to be really honest about it. So it's not necessarily an external threat. Tommy Robinson does one thing, and he's appropriating it because he's dressing himself up in the flag, because it's good for his donors, it's trying to set him off against Muslims, etc. But there are elements of Christian theology which are pushing it, like the Paul Marshalls of this world, which are really dangerous. And we've got to understand their agenda, and we've got to be prepared to take them on as well. I think people are starting to kind of, not so much wake up to it, but starting to kind of think about how to challenge it now, because we have to challenge it, and we have to challenge it internally inside churches and externally in society as well, because it's a different view of society. And it's not just in terms of Islam and immigration, but it's, you know, it's about women's rights, it's about, you know, gay rights, it's about all these other things as well, that the money that's coming in from the Christian right, from the US into the UK, is frightening. From, you know, and that's with a clear political agenda. We're talking about millions. They are literally sponsoring, they're sponsoring departments at Cambridge and at, you know, at Oxford. Peter Thiel, who's, people might know as, you know, one of these kind of right-wing, he's to the right of MAGA, but in America, but, you know, he runs all the NHS data and everything. You know, he's pumping hundreds of thousands every year into Oxford University. It's the same with Cambridge. They're funding conferences, they're funding papers. And some of it's connected up with race science. So I think, you know, this is a real challenge we have to have. And I think that that's probably a role. I mean, there's us, what we can all do on the ground, but there's a huge job for kind of church leaders, religious leaders to take this on as well, because it's a challenge to them. And it's a challenge to the way, you know, our Christian churches have been run in Britain for many, many years. So, you know, it's just another threat we face, but it's obviously a very particular threat to Christian communities. But it's a threat we have to take on.
On your behalf, can I thank the inspiration that is Nick Lowles his first green belt, but we hope not his last. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.